Session number 28625, reel 13.
And when you did go to these national service boards, the men who were coming along, you know, for their national service, had they any say in which regiment they wanted to go to?
They could express a preference that, which was given, if possible, but in some cases that didn't work out. But if they had a talent that warranted benefit in something specific, then they would obviously go there. Like an educated man would perhaps go to the education corps, and mechanical engineers and so on.
And did you get quite a few of them changing from maybe just being going in from their national service into a regular soldier?
Not many to start off. It was quite a cold sort of situation, really, to speak to men who were unaware of what the future held for them or what the circumstances would result in. Not too many, but you did have the odd one.
And how did the pay compare? Can you remember?
Oh, terrible. I used to feel very sorry for the young married man in particular, and if he had a child, that he'd be very lucky if he got 35 shillings a week. And to leave some of that to his wife to live on. And if he smoked, for example, and had his toothpaste and polishes and brushes and all these things to buy. No, it was a period of life that I think lots of them would have difficulty in forgetting about. They certainly wouldn't be overpaid.
So it's low compared to a normal everyday?
Well, very low, yes, indeed.
Right, okay.
Different now, I must say. They have been reinvigorated with a bit more realisation that if men are comfortable, then they react better.
And in the National Service days as well, you know, was it once they got to a certain age that they were drafted in, or was it like an age range from maybe 18 to 25 or something?
Yes, you're right in that one. You could have a preferred trade, for example, which would allow you to finish before they bring you in. But 18 to 25 was a mean average, I would think.
Okay. And were these men from all walks of life?
All walks of life, yeah.
Okay. And thinking back to Market Street office again, what type of display would you have in the window when it was a Gordon Highlander's time?
Dress, weaponry, travel, that sort of thing.
And did you find that that was bringing the young men in as well?
Well, again, it's a focal point. It's a starter for one, as it were. Helped. Seeing is believing. What is the caption? We used to say that Andy Stewart sings it, why don't you say it? A Gordon for me. That sort of gimmickry you had to try and work on.
And you mentioned Andy Stewart as well there, who did sing A Gordon for me.
Hmm.
Was that out by that time, that song?
Oh yes, been on the go for many years before that, I would say.
And do you think that helped Gordon recruiting? Did you ever meet him in person or anything?
No.
Okay. And a regular soldier as well, would they have earned more than a National Service one?
Precious. Little more. No. Not much more.
Okay. And you also mentioned walking out.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're in camp and when you finish your duties and you've got nothing else to do, you could walk out of camp, book out of camp and book in. And there was a period when you could only do so in uniform. And then, I think I mentioned it earlier, that there came a period when you could walk out in civilian clothes, which obviously most people prefer to do.
Okay. I thought that it was maybe when you were recruiting that you walked round the town or something.
We did that as well. When the idea was to meet people, see people, speak to people, let the people see that there were soldiers in the town, which you don't see now. Complete novelty. If I walked around Aberdeen and saw a soldier or anything in uniform now, sadly, very sadly, but in those days you would do a lot of that. You'd go to Highland Games, you'd walk around the building sites, you'd just think of anything that could give you an opportunity to speak to possible eligible boys.
And were you normally by yourself or was
in pairs? In pairs.
And how were you received?
Generally speaking, very well. We didn't have too many people being anti as they are currently for the least thing. And they were friendly then.
And what about your uniform? When you were walking out or when you were down at Marcus Street, what did you normally wear
then? Kilt. Kilt and battle dress blouse.
And what were your hours of work, you know?
We would start from the 8:30 to 5:00. But if there was something special on, then you didn't have hours as such. You were on call at any time.
Okay.
And at weekends, when naturally the public are off duty too. And that was the opportunity. So Saturdays and Sundays was invariably spent away somewhere.
Were you ever in the bars or anything?
Bars?
Ah, you know, trying to find men.
No. I do recall one of the core chaps using that, but we didn't, no.
Okay. And at that point as well, was there still like a Fian market or anything in Aberdeen?
No.
That was away by then?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Did you get a lot of men from the farming side of Aberdeen and Aberdeen?
Not as many as you used to, because there's less people employed in farms now than...
Well, we're speaking about the Fian side of things.
Yes, there's less people employed in farms, so that was effective in the 60s.
Okay, and were you quite successful in getting recruits at that period?
Okay. I remember the first year we got 68, as a figure it sticks in my mind, which is quite surprising and healthy.
Okay. And were you still an acting sergeant major?
No, I was still a sergeant.
Okay. And was there another regiment using the barracks? Oh no, was the barracks closed?
No, the barracks were still training recruits then.
Okay. And so was it still the Gordon?
Yes. Then, yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
But you didn't have anything to do with...
No, but when I left recruiting, I was sought after by the commanding officer of the depot. And he arranged that I go to the depot and start training recruits.
And which year was that?
In 1958.
And why did you leave recruiting?
Because he wanted me to join his team, and I was quite keen to go, so off I went.
And how did your hours of work vary then? Did it change?
Oh, much, much longer, much more involved. You were dealing with a raw recruit coming in, and you had to look after him for 10, 12 weeks, which included weekends. And yes, we were very involved, but... It was rewarding.
And did your wife accept the extra hours?
Yes. Never had any problems in that respect.
And did you like working up at the barracks?
Yes, I did. Yes, very good.
Okay. And did you have to train them in all aspects of, you know,
yes,
being a soldier?
Mm-hmm. How to get out of bed in the morning and clean their kit and dress themselves properly and march as a united body, and discipline, shooting, tactics, all that sort of thing. And you were being tested yourself if you had the ability and the natural instinct to train them. And you didn't, because certainly I never accepted people who failed. If they failed, it's because I had failed. But, that kept you going.
And so did any of your men ever actually fail, or did you manage to get them through it?
You always managed somehow or other to coerce them into doing it and giving them extra attention. That meant that your team of corporals who worked with you, they were, you know, you worked as a team through it.
And did the army give you extra training, you know, in maybe different ways of teaching the ones who had difficulties to get on? Was there different?
No, you were, I mean, bear in mind I'd instructed officers for 2 years, so I'd been well enough trained in lots of aspects in dealing with such a variety of people and types of people that you were soon identifying and able to resolve things.
And did you find any differences, you know, between maybe the young lads who went into Sandhurst and the young lads who went along to the barracks?
Other than academic level, I wouldn't say there was much between them, really. You had people who were basically lazy and need more attention than the others who aren't. Certainly, there was a sort of psychological appreciation you had to make now and again when to pat on the back or boot the bum.
Okay, and how long did you remain in that job for?
Well, I did that for over a year when the commanding officer sent and promoted me, slightly prematurely, I may say, for promotion to colour sergeant. So that allowed me to get off the training side and go into the administrative side, where I issued them with all the bits and pieces that they wanted, whether it be the bedding, the utensils, or the uniforms, and the weaponry, and things like that.
And did you want to go into the administration?
Well, it's all part of the sort of graduation of promotion, that you move to the side, you move up, you move to the side, and you're gaining more information and more experience.
So you were quite happy with
it? Oh, yes.
Okay. And why do you think he, when you said that he promoted you prematurely, what do you mean by that?
That he obviously thought that I was the best one that he had there, as he wanted to do the job, because it was leading up to, in 1960, closing down the barracks and moving the recruit training up to Fort George. And that was the bill that I fulfilled.
Okay, and whereabout was the regiment at this point? Were they still in England?
They had left England and went to Celle in Germany in 58, I would say.
And did you not want to go with them?
Yes, I eventually, as the story will reveal, soon after closing the depot as a colour sergeant, which had been on the go since 1940 something, when the Royal Artillery had it, and I then joined the 1st Battalion with my family in Celle and became a colour sergeant of a company.
Okay. And how did you adjust to being a colour sergeant? You know, you've been training men, and now you are changed across to the colour sergeant and issuing equipment and everything, as you said. Did you have to learn a lot, or did, you know, was it just...
Yes, it was a progressional thing that you were learning how to account for things. You were given responsible areas and various items, and inventories were made of everything. So you were solely responsible for the accountancy of that, and therefore you had to issue and receive and be fully aware of who had what and where was it.
And was there training you got for that?
Not really. Not at that time. No, this was again the watch, look, listen and learn.
And had the last man been there who had been doing the job, did you put, you know, was he still there that you could be by his side for a
short? Yes, you normally had a handover period of perhaps a week or so.
And did you have men working for you? You know,
yes, you had your own team of storemen. You had two who looked after the weaponry and another two who looked after the general issues and bedding and things like that.
And did you enjoy that?
Yes.
Okay. And were your hours of work more normal then?
In theory, yes, but not so. There was always a requirement for something, and you had to be prepared throughout your stage in the army to accept that.
And I know that we've spoken before about the certificates you needed, you know, to become a sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
Did you need anything more to become a colour sergeant?
Not a colour sergeant. I was qualified educationally for that, but whilst in Aberdeen, I attended the university for lectures, etc., and eventually took my last two subjects. That gave me a first class certificate, and that took me up to warrant officer.
And was it the university that ran these courses?
Yes, it was just I was applying as a normal citizen for whatever subject that you needed.
Okay, so it was like a university degree or something?
Not a degree, no, you just attended. You got nothing at the end of it. It was just a knowledgeable lecture series that they ran.
And what type of subjects did they cover?
Well, I took at that particular time citizenship.
And what did it look at? Do you remember? Was it like an international citizenship? Or?
No, United Kingdom. I mean, made you aware of who, what and where run the country and all the way down to different structures that are necessary.
Okay, and so did you set an exam at the end of
the... The military one. Armed with the knowledge that I got from the college, I was then able to go on and set the exam that the military had set.
And was that still in Aberdeen or somewhere else?
In Aberdeen. We had an educational centre there. Right? Just as we had a church and a cinema, they were pretty self-contained, and the educational instructors were all very well qualified, degreed people. And the certificate or the examination was a military one in that it came from the headquarters of the military in England. So it was distributed to whoever was wanting and required the examination.
Okay. And you mentioned the church and everything. Was that all within the barracks?
Yep.
Right, okay. And so how long did you remain in the job of the colour sergeant issuing the equipment in Aberdeen?
Well, I closed the depot in 1960 and then moved to Celle in Germany to join the regiment.
And why was the depot being closed?
Because they were restructuring the training system and putting all the Highland regiments to train at Fort George and all the Lowland regiments to move down and train at Glencorse.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Strachan.
Good morning, Arnie.
The last time that we were speaking about the Gordon Highlanders, you were still at the Gordon Barracks, which I believe was the late 1950s.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
No, you said that you were the colour sergeant there.
Uh-huh.
And that the depot was about to close.
Yes.
And, well, what happened then? Did you have to actually close the depot, or...?
Well, we actually closed it in early 1960. It meant all the soldiers going elsewhere, in our case up to Fort George and Inverness. And the adult soldiers going to join the regiment who were in Germany. And then we had to return all the accommodation stores and equipment back to Ordnance Services, who were the controller of them.
And was that in Aberdeen or were they elsewhere?
They had to be sent elsewhere, predominantly Stirling, which was the depot then.
And did that create a lot of work?
Oh yes, a lot of slow and meticulous work. You had to make sure that you accounted for absolutely everything that had been listed in your inventories, and they had to be in good condition.
And was that absolutely everything at the depot that you had to look after? You know, is that what your job was?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, like equipment, uniforms,
yes,
accommodation and
yes,
everything.
I wasn't directly responsible for everything. I was just a senior member of a group of people who, in their own way, the transport was looked after by somebody and the weaponry by another person and so on. But I did buildings and the accommodation services, the beds, the bed-ins and equipment.
So the bedding and the beds and all that all went away, did it?
Yes.
So it was absolutely empty.
Uh-huh.
And do you remember roughly how long it took you to do all this?
Not really. Certainly 4 months, I should think.
And do you remember how you felt when you first found out that the depot was going to close?
There's a degree of sadness any time you leave a historic site, which Gordon Barracks was, that epitomised all that the Gordon Hamlet was about. A historic area, I must admit. But you were aware that at one time something else would take over the barracks, and this in fact turned out to be true.
And you know, just prior to closure, you know, while the men were still there, had there been a lot of people at the barracks, you know, that you had then to get moved out, either to go to Germany or to Fort George?
Yes, they did it progressively. It was like everything else now. They were very well planned and staged so that there would be the minimum disruption and the maximum effort from people. There was a progression of events.
And what happened to the family accommodation at the Gordon Barracks as well?
That was utilised by the Ministry of Defence in that it was an overflow for any unit in the Aberdeen area, and the RAF at Kinlochmouth or wherever. In fact, my quarter was handed over to an RAF man and his family. And they continue to do this even to this day. We all belong to the same boss in that element.
And when you did have family accommodation like yourself there, was all your furniture and goods not supplied by the army?
Yes, every house was fully furnished. You could walk in and find that everything you required to sleep, to be comfortable in, to eat, to cook, even a coal shovel, a scuttle, an axe, a garland equipment. It was a fully furnished house, recorded on an inventory, which was checked for serviceability and quantity each time you marched in, as they called it, and again when you marched out. And at present, at these march-ins and march-outs, members of the ordnance services and the civilian men who looked after the state of the buildings, the park of work, for example. And everybody had to be satisfied that it was in a serviceable condition.
And was this quite difficult? Was it, was there often maybe little disputes or differences of opinions?
Yes, that's the human side of it. That you'd fight your corner. You would obviously. Everything wasn't brand new when each occupant went in. It had to be serviceable. And if it was classified as serviceable, obviously it wasn't pristine condition. So at the end, after its period of use, independent on the occupant, there could be little nicks and scratches and bends and bumps in it. And if the person who had issued it consider this to be unfair damage, then a charge against the person was raised. And like in all cases, if you disputed that, then there was a chain of command of which you could go through to fight it. But mostly a very fair examination. And if you were an honest-to-goodness citizen, you didn't have problems.
And was this a monetary charge they gave you, or was this like an army charge,
A monetary, yes. It appertained purely to you as an occupant of a residence. And the paperwork was done, and if it was a financial charge, then it was debited from your account. And you naturally had to acknowledge the guilt and sign it before it was transacted.
And see, when you are in an army accommodation as well, do the soldiers actually pay rent for this accommodation, or is it part of your wages?
Long ago it was part of the wages, but now they do pay for food and accommodation. So if you don't want to eat, you don't pay for it. Whereas in the olden days, that was taken into consideration when they were assessing their scales of salaries and wages.
Okay. So by the time you left the barracks, would it be fair to say that there was maybe just a skeleton staff or something?
Yes, it was eventually reduced to, I think I had 6 men living in a boarding house, for example, and they would come in daily until we got all the bits and pieces away. Because obviously in your rundown you had to stop your cooking, stop your provisioning and all of these things, and you have to be a sort of self-supported unit.
And where about was your wife and family at this time?
She remained in Gawn Barracks until I left and went to Germany in June. She went home to her mother, and then she joined me out in Germany in June.
Okay, and when you left to go to Germany, were there any other men from the Gordon Highlanders went with you? Or?
Yes, I actually, having closed Aberdeen, moved to Fort George, which was the new area for training Gordon Highlanders, along with other regiments, other Highland regiments. And from that, obviously, they were training recruits, and I took a draft of men out to Germany. Each time, I think when they completed a phase of training, they would have their leave and then be dispatched to somebody. And I took one such group out.
And how many men are in a draft?
Well, it varied. It could be 10, 50, it could be anything. And we're just known as a draft.
And were these just young recruits who
yes.
had done their
yes.
basic training?
Yes. And in addition to that, anybody else who may be coming back from other areas where they had been soldiers and were going back to the 1st Battalion, they would do so through Fort George, the dispatching unit.
Okay. So were you at Fort George for any length of time after the barracks closed?
Not really. Perhaps a month.
Okay. And do you remember how you travelled out to Germany?
We went to that in that one by train.